Welcome to From the Rooker End. We are outside Vicarage Road after Watford 1, Southampton 1. It didn't feel like that. It was a last-minute goal. It was amazing stuff. But Mike, a performance that... not surprising performance from Watford, but one we can all get behind.
Yeah, it did. It's one of those. It felt like a win. 95th minute equaliser from the, probably the most unexpected source. I don't think many people would be clutching their Bet365 slip going, yes, Reece Healy with the goal for Watford. But what's really, really struck me sort of watching this game was how enjoyable this Watford side is to watch again. And I think personally, I'd sort of forgotten how to... I have been enjoying this season, but it's been a long time since I could say that, really, with any conviction. And I think the way that this team has turned itself around under Valerian Ismail... I was there at Leeds and then watched the Sunderland game on the TV, and we all know how disappointed we all were with those performances. They looked lost at sea, they looked directionless, they looked lacking in confidence, they're out of shape. It just wasn't fun. And to see... out there again today, following from that incredible win away at Hull, that come from behind win against Norwich, it's everything we haven't been for so long. And I think we've been so used to looking for the cracks, looking for where we need to improve. That's not good enough, this isn't good enough, Pozzo doesn't do this, this is going on, that's going on, when ultimately what we come to the football for is what we've just seen, is 3 till 4:45 or 7:45 to half time, whatever it is. That, and we sort of almost feel like we haven't allowed ourselves to enjoy it. We haven't stopped to think about what the team are delivering for us. And that, this afternoon, I thought was something that, without any reservation, yes, they're not the greatest team we've ever seen in yellow, but they're giving it absolutely everything. They look organised. There's not really any square pegs in round holes. We're not the best division in the Championship by an absolute mile. We weren't the best team on the pitch today by a long shot. But it's a team we can sort of believe in. Mm. And I feel a little bit whether we're not allowing ourselves to necessarily support this team like we potentially have done in the past. And I think as a fan base now, moving into December, well, we're in December, it's really, really busy. Loads of games, games under the lights. It'd be lovely for us all to come together, sort of just to sort of forget all the nonsense that's going on and just raise the sort of atmosphere in the Vic a little bit, get it bouncing again. Because I think this team, it deserves it. We've talked about that the crowd feeds off the team, and that is absolutely right. Well, I think the team have done their bit, and yeah, we should start enjoying this while it lasts.
Someone who did enjoy it, David, particularly at the end, Mr. Reece Healy with the equaliser. Talk us through it.
It was an amazing moment because we needed. I think it was, you know, as Mike said, we hung in there today, but it did feel at times that maybe it just, you know, we just weren't going to have quite enough, or the ball wasn't going to fall for us. But it was going to take that sort of moment, I think, for us to get back into the game and get the point. And it was a goal that perhaps was a bit fortunate, but it came out of sheer determination, really, and an amazing leap from Bio to win the flick on after the long ball. And Healy just had a punt. He's just taking it on, and it looked initially like it wasn't going to go in. He didn't catch it very sweetly. It wasn't the best strike, but it's, I think because of that, it's caught the keeper sort of unaware a little bit, and he's wrong-footed. I don't know whether he didn't see it or whether he got his foot caught in the turf or wasn't expecting it. But he had otherwise had a really good game, made an amazing save from Espria earlier in the second half, and the Saints fans were chanting his name. He's a good keeper, but he's let a bad one in there. And it's an amazing moment for us. It's a deserved point, and it's a brilliant moment for Healy. You can see how much it meant to him. Mm. The players ran off the bench at the end and were straight over to him, all of them embracing him. And I think it was Pollock maybe who brought him over pointing at him at the end. And, you know, fair play to him, because it's not gone well for him so far. He's not been fit, he's not been on the pitch, but he's, you know, when he has come on, he's run around, and he did get an assist earlier in the season, but like, he's kept going, and he's got a moment there today to be proud of. And even if his Watford career doesn't go on to be an amazing one, he'll always have that moment at least. And also, we've got a set piece specialist, a long throw specialist up our sleeves that we didn't know about.
It was amazing, because in the first one, he was there, you said, Jason, he was there taking the throw and thinking, why is he taking the throw in? There's got to be a reason why he's taking. Oh, look at that! Like, and then we're at the other side, the ball went off the other side, and he trotted over. I think Ken was going to take it, and then you can see Valerian go, no, wait. It's like, We know there's a magic wand there, and it's going to be resealed at some point.
It's like one of those toys you used to get in the 80s, and you just sort of clip it back into something, then unleash a clasp, and it flicks some sort of penny or Play-Doh or something into the TV, and you break that, and then you get in trouble. But yeah, absolutely. And where that's been hiding, absolutely. Well, it's been hiding on the bench with Reece Healy, hasn't it? But yeah, just another lovely little subplot to a really interesting afternoon. And I think we're obviously going to go and talk about Southampton, but I think they allowed us back into it to a degree after looking like a pretty decent football team. I think they made a major error in allowing us to build up that head of steam. We had to do that. Valerian Ismail had to make the substitutions. I think they worked to a degree. Fair play to him for bringing Reece Healy on. You could say that he's got nothing left to lose, and he hasn't really. But he brought Edo Kayembe off with a couple of minutes to go. He might have just thought, well, the game's up, but not a bit of it. We rolled the dice one last time and came up. It's coming up Snake Eyes good, or is that bad? I don't know. Anyway, we rolled the dice and we got whatever we wanted. We got Snake Eyes is 2-1s and it finished 1-1. So I'll back that.
Hey. Jace, though, we didn't feel like at any point like Southampton dominated us. They showed what they were, but they didn't dominate us anyway.
They probably dominated in some areas. They're a good team. They've got a lot of Premier League players that played with them last season, and you could see that quality on the pitch. They were very comfortable on the ball. They were able to move it around quickly. We were having to drop reasonably deep, and so in terms of our formation at times, I said to you at one point we were defending in a 7-2-1. That's how they were, but that worked. We were plugging the gaps. There was a lot of good movement from them. Like talking during the game about, they were finding gaps sort of between Andrews and Porges, or Porges would go and vacate his usual position like he likes to, and they were sort of making really good runs, but there was always someone there to cover as well, I think. And despite all that good play, from good passing football from them, they didn't have a shot until the second half. Ben Hamer had nothing to do in that first half, and you've got to credit the guys. That's as much a part of the game as the attacking, as trying to score the goals. It's keeping the opposition out, and we did a very good job of that in the first half.
We did. I think we did an exceptional job in that first half. It's one of my favourite halves of
nil-nil.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a nil. I love that nil-nil.
But Southampton were demonstrably comfortable. They were doing. We knew what they were going to do. They're going to pass the ball. They're going to keep the ball. It always felt like they had another couple of gears to go up through, so it did feel like it was going to be a long afternoon at times. But what I loved about that first half was the way that Watford dealt with what they were doing. As Jason said, Ben Hamer didn't have much to do. It wasn't like we were frantically scrambling. We knew what was coming and we dealt with it. Much like you're talking about Wes Hurt sort of last week, they knew that their whole keeper played off and they gave it a go. They're working at it and they're executing out on the pitch. But more than that was the way that Watford grew into the game. They absorbed what the challenge was in front of them in terms of Southampton, worked out how to deal with that as best they could. Not only that, they then put their foot down themselves a little bit. I thought they had joy down both wings. Jamal Lewis is looking like a decent player for us and going forward. And Ryan Andrews, what a tremendous amount of fun he is to have on the pitch. He's quick, he's skillful, he's brave, he gets into good positions. And we gave the Southampton defenders something to worry about. And coming to the game today, we knew that so the word in my head was test. This is going to be a really, really good test. On the back of last week against Hull, that was a test we came through it. Norwich was a different test we came through that. This is probably a step up from those. Southampton, really, really decent form. And they passed that test, certainly in the first half, with flying colours. The way they were able to manoeuvre themselves into the game and look like proper footballers asking big questions of a decent opposition was good. And that made it all the more disappointing, I think, when they scored relatively quickly in the second half. You couldn't argue it hadn't been coming, really, in terms of the possession. When you have that much of the football, eventually something's gonna creak. And Watford did creak after that, I felt. And it was hands to the pump then. It could have gone badly for us, I think, at that stage. Everything went... It was quite sedate up until that point, wasn't it? Southampton doing what they do, moving the ball around without asking too many questions. Watford playing some decent stuff themselves. It was quite... But everyone looked like they knew what they were doing. And then it all went a bit berserk for a little bit. And for Watford to hang on in there at that stage, keep it at 1-0, not lose their head entirely. Ryan Porteous obviously chopped someone in half. But, I mean, fair enough. You need to do that to get a booking in this game. I thought the ref was poor. I thought he set his stall out very early by not booking a couple of Southampton players. I'm not big on sort of moaning about that sort of thing, but I think there was Walker Peters in
particular. Can I just check our WhatsApp group?
Yeah, well, no, they've done a Boris Johnson. They've all been any WhatsApps between 3 and 4:45. WhatsApp must have been down or something. Yeah, I thought he didn't book them, and then it sort of it made it effectively a little bit lawless in terms of the challenges, the level of challenges that he let go, and it took. I think it was Armstrong in the end who absolutely snapped into one. And but you foster that environment as a ref, and you either get on top of it and you say, look, you can't do that, or you don't, and it just built and it built and it built, and ultimately it worked in Watford's favour in the end because it gave us that fervour. It allowed us to build up that head of steam. Southampton were, you know, absolute nonsensical time wasting towards the end. It was really, really poor from a side who should have put us away before that, to be honest. But I did think the ref was bad, and I think you've got but the fact that Southampton were making those fouls, and it was obvious that we were thinking, well, that should be yellow card, was credit to Watford and how he had them on the back foot. Walker Peters is supposed to be a Premier League level footballer, and he was getting, you know, we had him on toast. So the ref was bad, but I think that the fact that that was brought into focus was because Watford were playing pretty well.
Dave, the worry, I suppose, the question we said coming towards the game after seeing Livermore not starting, Livermore not even on the bench, worry is not the word, you know, but the how important he seems to have become to the role he plays in the midfield, but also almost like the freedom and the comfort he gives to the players. We kept Southampton quiet for the first half. Do you think we did miss him, though?
Yeah, I think we did. I can't quite remember off the top of my head, but I know, Mike, you commented in the wake of the Southampton goal that Sirelta, you know, got pulled out of position a little bit. And, which isn't necessarily to say that he was solely to blame, and he did his best. He's never going to let you down. But Livermore's a specialist in that position, a very experienced central midfield player, and we've seen the value that he brings to the team in recent weeks once he's got up to speed. And it's a shame that he, you know, has got an injury, but I think Ishmael said before the game, you know, it's not a serious injury, but he's so important to us that we don't want to risk him, and we have to manage his fitness long term. So I think that tells you everything in terms of his importance to the team. And yeah, Sirelta was fine, but we kind of know what he's going to give us in that position. But I don't think he did a bad job, but I think, you know, you'd have Livermore in there every day of the week if he's fit.
If there was a game that we were going to miss Livermore and have Sirelta in there, that was probably it, because Sirelta, his natural thing is to go back, which you're a centre back, that's bound to be. You're not under pressure, you're not under massive amounts of pressure from Southampton today. It was played at that sort of relatively sedate pace. They're not flying into tackles, they're not closing you down massively. So to be honest, that turn and back pass, it was absolutely fine, and it sort of worked in the game. And I think it just shows, you know, who am I to sort of commend Valerian Ismail for his common sense when it comes to football, but it's not worth risking. It's a long season. December is chock-a-block. He's shown how vital he is, and fair play to Francisco Sirelta. And you don't complain, but you know he's limited. He is going to go back. And then when he did try and sort of turn and play a ball forward late on in the game, he got caught out.
Yeah.
I think he did what he had to do, but we undoubtedly miss Livermore. He's a captain without the armband as well. And that Norwich game, when there were mistakes, he's going and patting people on the back and geeing everyone up. And you can argue that that's anyone can do that, but not everyone does. And he is obviously respected. Hopefully we can get him back. Massive test on Tuesday. Ipswich have won again on the road away at Middlesbrough. They look absolutely formidable. So another big test, and hopefully he's going to be fit for that.
Yeah. First off, although there was one aspect where I thought we did miss him was when Hamer had the ball, Livermore would normally drop deep and show for the ball, whereas Sirelta seemed to be pushing further forward and sort of moving away from the ball. And there are a few times where sort of Hamer's standing on it, he hasn't got an option, he's looking for an option, there's nothing in the middle, and eventually he gets closed down and he's sort of having to hurry his kick and looking a bit uncomfortable. Funnily enough, first time he gets the ball, second half, Sirelta's dropped deep and shown for him, so I don't know if Ishmael said something to him at half time. But first half, I thought that was missing a bit. No, just a small thing.
It's probably natural. He doesn't want the ball that close to his own as a defender. You want the ball down the other end as quickly as possible. But I think as far as being an able deputy, it's a difficult job to be asked to step out from centre back to play that role. And yet he did all right.
Anybody else stand out for you?
I thought Kayembe stood out again. I thought we had another good performance for him. Rajovic was asked to do a job that's really, really difficult for him, but I thought, and he needed more support, and at times Kayembe was the one pushing forward and sort of showing when Rajovic was maybe looking isolated. So yeah, him getting forward, picking up on some loose balls that were coming off, sort of that were pinging off Rajovic maybe, or showing to be another option moving forward when everyone was maybe sitting back more in that 7-2-1 formation. It's a performance that we've seen from him a lot in recent weeks, and he's starting to look like one of the first names on the team sheet for me at the moment.
Another one that caught the eye, the other K, Ismail Kone, and I think we're seeing his career development in real time. He came to us with very, very little professional football under his belt, and we knew what we were getting in that regard, slightly skewed by the fact he's played international football. But I think he's developing a pace. He looks more confident. He looks more comfortable on the ball. He looks more threatening. He looks stronger. He looks just more at ease.
Confident? That oozes now.
It does, but also what we're seeing is that he's still very, very raw.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of sums up this entire Watford side, really. The stuff they really enjoy there, but I think what he does, he hangs onto the ball too often, or then when he does pick the pass, it's the wrong one. And that, you know, that comes with experience and age and all those sort of things. He's been playing proper football, if you like, for two seasons, the high-level football for two seasons. I've been talking on this podcast for 14 seasons and still don't make any sense. So I think he's a real... I've enjoyed watching him develop, but he's still frustrating. I think there was one time Lewis absolutely busted his balls to get down the left-hand side. We were in, just needed that ball from Kone, and he overhit it. It happens. But I think he's a real good sort of representation of this side. Stuff we can get behind, support, enjoy watching, but not quite the finished article yet.
But we're back here again on Tuesday in the cold. You're going to bring your gloves this time, Dave?
Yeah, yeah. I will. I think it's going to, as Mike said, I think it's going to be a really difficult game. Ipswich are, I think, an even better side than Southampton. They keep the ball as well. Scored an amazing goal last week, which sort of rivaled Hoots, really, in a different way. But it was a brilliant goal. They're a good side. They could very easily get promoted. So it's another big test. But I think, again, hopefully we'll rise to it. And I think we should be confident.
We're the Orns, you're the Orns. Come on, you Orns!
Unfortunate news this week, the passing of Martin Patching. Played for Watford from 1979 to 1983, where he was a well-loved person. And we were trying to find a way to sort of sum him up. And there was a fantastic article, which Martin wrote himself for Look at the Stars, the fanzine, from a few years ago. It was posted on the Watford Treasury's website, and I asked if it was okay if we sort of vocalised it. So Colin, here's Colin reading the article that Martin wrote about his last game at Watford, which happened to be the game that Watford finished second in the top tier of football, Martin scoring the goal against Liverpool.
At the far post, Martin Patching concludes his look at the 1982-83 season with a lump in his throat. As you may or may not imagine, I have tossed these 500 or so words around on numerous occasions, ultimately coming to the somewhat cliched conclusion, it's a fairy tale. Injured for some 20 months following two knee operations at London Harley Street Clinic, I was far removed from the player who joined Watford from Wolves in 1979 for £125,000. My fee, not my salary, weekly or annually. With a contract running out and little sign of it being extended, I remained in limbo, fit yet unfit, young yet experienced. Such a dilemma. For most of the reserve games, I was captain during the 1982-83 season, with the amiable John Ward at the helm. We worked hard, had much fun, and young players came through the ranks showing much promise. For two long and lonely years, the backbone of the club urged me on. Tom Wally, who himself had played with a knee injury so bad, he understood the all-important mental aspect of such a situation. The late, great and sorely missed Roy Clare lifted my spirits. Roy served as Watford kit man, players' confidant, reserve team physio and everyone's favourite uncle. Roy also had 25 years' experience in the RAF to call on. In short, a big man. From GT, empathy. A player never wants to finish playing, least through injury. Graham had experienced similar. Pat Malloy had a lifetime of experience to draw from. Billy Hales was the club physio. Billy pushed me, pulled me, and we bantered and talked for hours. Now in my prime, it is Billy I thank for giving me great reserves of strength, for it was him who suggested I should carry the giant frame of Roy Clare on my back whilst running up the Vicarage Road terracing. The late Bertie Mee, highly respected and qualified in the medical world, overlooked my slow progress. During my treatment room nightmare, many players came and went, some quickly. Pat Rice with a niggle, Big Ross with a strain, or Luther with a bruise on top of a bruise. Others reluctantly stayed longer. Kenny Jacket had cartilage trouble. Young Neil Price the same. Fellow smoker and lover of Indian food, Ian Bolton, had serious problems in the lumbar region. Webby and I attacked the football cafe menu with bunterish aplomb. Most combinations enjoyed to the full. The rigours of the rehabilitation programme produced an enormous appetite. However, in the build-up to the last game of the season, certain twists and turns saw me take the field. The Football League medical officer had declared my knee unfit for pro football, and I took up the post of manager of the Red Lion at Potton End, while still playing for the reserves and training full-time. On the Sunday, prior to the Liverpool game, the squad were having a wonderful night out at the Watford Observer End of Season Awards held at Bailey's in the town. Towards the end of the evening, Eddie Plumley, who was then chief executive at the club, visited my table and shared a joke or two, as well as several drinks. On leaving, Eddie passed me a note saying, "The boss sends this." The note contained a message from Graham Taylor saying words to the effect, "If you put that cigarette out now, due to injuries, you will be in the team next Saturday." Well, I did, and I was, and had a splendid time indeed. On the eve of the game, I served a few pints behind the bar, changed a barrel of Benskins and made my excuses, heading for an early night. The sun shone brightly the following day and well into the early evening. The yellow brick road had finished one curb short of the top spot. If you witnessed the game, hopefully it remains in the memory bank to this day. If you were less fortunate or too young, I scored the winner. There were 50,000 there, and Elton cooked bacon and eggs for the players after the match while singing Crocodile Rock, playing the piano and the frying pan simultaneously. In what is a wonderful life, it was a mile-high point for me. Here for the record of the facts. Saturday, the 14th of May, 1983, Football League Division 1, Watford 2, Liverpool 1. 27,173 attendance. Watford, Sherwood, Rice, Sims, Franklin, Rostron. Callaghan, Patching, Jacket, Sterling. Blissett, Barnes. Sub, Lohman. Scorers, Patching, 39 minutes. Blissett, 48 minutes. Liverpool, Grobbelaar, Neil, Lawrenson, Hanson, Thompson, Lee, Souness, Johnston, Kennedy, Dalgleish, Hodgson, Sub, Nickel, Scorer, Johnston, 62 minutes. There were various other factors which made this more than a football match. It was to be Liverpool manager Bob Paisley's last game in charge of the First Division champions. If we avoided defeat, we would be runners-up. The referee, Mr. A.W. Gray from Great Yarmouth, was officiating his last league fixture. It was also my last league game. During the build-up to the game, Graham Taylor had given free transfers to Ian Bolton and Ross Jenkins, much to the fans' surprise. Paul Franklin made his league debut, and Worrell Sterling made his first home bow. Both produced memorable displays. Paul was named man of the match, having contained Kenny Dalgleish on the day. But in part due to his knee injury, he was unable to fulfil his promise as a top-flight centre-back. In concluding, I will quote the inimitable Ollie Phillips, Watford Observer report published the following week. "Taylor, penchant for tossing in the unexpected caused as much confusion in Patching's mind as it did the Liverpool defence. This was not so much a match as a great sporting occasion and pure theatre. These words are so tangible, almost edible to this reader. They sit somewhat uncomfortably alongside the Sunday headlines from that weekend, which announced Patching earns pints and Roy of the Rovers return. It makes one even more appreciative of Ollie's contributions over the years. When the time comes, I'm sure he will miss it, as we will miss him. As for the confusion in my mind, well, I deal with it on a daily basis. See you at the near post, or thereabouts. Patch.
Some of you might have been early at the Watford shop. I can see people inside there now buying things for Christmas. One of them, of course, is being books. There is the Watford Treasury book, which we spoke about last week to Jeff and to Colin. Make sure you get the Golden Shots and Visions of Blue. It's a beautiful thing to look through. But also there's a new book out called Watford Forever by John Preston, written in collaboration with Elton John. And it does tell that story of the golden years of Watford, which in some ways we've heard many, many times, but not necessarily through the eyes of Sir Elton. So I caught up with John this week to find out about the book and why a man who doesn't support Watford wants to spend the time writing many thousands of words about our football club.
When Graham Taylor died at the beginning of 2017... Elton released a statement saying that the two of them had been like blood brothers and how Graham had effectively saved his life by setting him on the road to recovery. And a friend of mine saw this and told me about it and said, this is a really good story. You should try and do something about it. And I had interviewed Elton once years before, and I still had an email for David Furnish, his husband. So I wrote to David saying, this is a really good story, could we meet and talk about it? Thinking the likelihood I would get a reply was next to nothing. But I did get a reply, and he said, oh, come in and talk about it. Then I remember the end of the interview, David said, meetings don't go much better than this, do they? And I came home and I told my wife, I bet you I never hear from them again. But I did hear from them again very soon afterwards, and they said, come out to France and talk to Elton about it. So I went out to France and Elton was keen on the idea. I think for a number of reasons, he felt that it was an area of his life that certainly wasn't unknown, but it was less well known than his musical career. And their sons, one of them, who I think would have been about 11 or 12 at the time, was, I believe, training with Watford Juniors. I think Elton and David felt that it would be a nice idea to have something tangible, i.e. a book, that they could give to their boys, which they wouldn't necessarily have to look at now, but, you know, in future years would be a kind of record of what Elton had accomplished at Watford. So it kind of went on from there, really.
And you looking at it in terms of you weren't looking at it as a football book?
I was looking at it. To me, it had kind of three distinct strands to it. There was the friendship between Elton and Graham. There was also, of course, what they had achieved in taking Watford from the bottom of the then fourth division up to the top of the first division. But I also, because I knew how important this was to Graham, wanted to look at the effect that it had on the town. Because Graham had been, when he was had been at Lincoln City, which was where he was before he came to Watford, he had instigated these things, which were very radical at the time, like all the players had to live within a 10-mile radius of the ground. And it was in their contract that they had to visit schools and factories and hospitals. And the whole sort of ethos of that was to instill in them the idea that they were no better than the supporters. And if they thought they were, then woe betide them, because they'd effectively be out on their arse. When Graham first met Elton, he said rather hesitantly, well, you know, if I was to come to Watford, that's what I'd like to do. And actually, Elton was completely behind him. And it seemed to me that this was, in an odd sort of way, a story about a town getting its heart back.
Do you feel that there was a thing with Elton, though? Because that's, again, that's the thing that I found most interesting about the book, was hearing his point of view. Do you feel he had that passion for Watford? He'd been going since he was a boy. But do you feel that actually he knew he could do something with it? Because we know the story of possibility of getting Bobby Moore as manager. It would have been a glamorous thing and a big investment. When it clicked for him that this was actually going to grow what it, even a little bit bigger than what he maybe even dreamt it was going to be, was there a moment, do you think, for him?
It's odd because, you know, in one sense, this is the story of shy, only child Reggie Dwight being taken to Vicarage Road by his father when he was six, and his father reaching down and taking him by the hand as they walked to the ground, something that had never happened before. And when they got to the ground, Elton Reggie saw a side of his father that he'd never seen before, because he was cheering and whooping and booing and all the rest of it. I think it was really only at those moments in Elton's childhood that he felt that he was the son that his father wanted him to be. So it was an incredibly sort of visceral connection with Watford. And then he becomes Elton John, and he becomes famous very, very quickly, and presumably rich very quickly. And, you know, in 76, he buys Watford. Not that he really had to buy it, of course, because Jim Bonser by this point was desperate to get it off his hands. But the one of the key differences between Reg Dwight and Elton John, as it were, is that Reg Dwight was a very, very shy boy, and Elton John was kind of unclouded by self-doubt in many respects. So when he bought the club, it never bothered him for a moment that, you know, Watford were kind of perennially anchored to the bottom of Division 4. I mean, I know that's a wild simplification, but it's not entirely untrue. I think that he felt an absolute conviction that he could get Watford to wherever he wanted them to go. And, of course, when he and Graham first met, and, you know, Graham said, well, what are your ambitions for this club? Elton said, well, you know, I wanted to get us into Europe, which, of course, was, you know, an insanely pie-in-the-sky thing to say. And I think, you know, for Graham Taylor, there was a part of him that thought, you know, this guy's absolutely nuts. But I also think that he was, you know, he found it kind of rather inspirational and was sort of fired up by Elton's enthusiasm. And, you know, lo and behold, it happened.
Let me change that. The story that we know, and this underdog story, we love an underdog story. You know, we've seen the Wimbledon story, in many ways, the Nottingham Forest story, how they went to Europe. And we feel it's a little bit unknown, I suppose. Everyone knows Elton John owned Watford. It's the one thing I always get when I say, oh, where you're from, anywhere around the world. I say, I'm from Watford. They go, oh, Elton John. Where does it sit for you? Do you think it's a possibility for this? Yeah, there's loads of documentaries out there that have all these other, you know, underdog stories. There's never been one about Watford.
And I think that, and possibly one of the reasons for this is that there was a kind of assumption amongst people outside Watford, which drove, has always driven Elton absolutely nuts, incidentally, that Graham basically bought a team with Elton's money. And that simply, as you well know, didn't happen. And as Elton has always said, you can't do that. It just doesn't work. Apart from anything else, Graham had an almost kind of pathological dislike of spending any more of Elton's money than he felt he had to. And I think in many respects, for me, the most extraordinary thing about the Watford story is that they went from the bottom to the top with four of the same players who'd been on the bottom, the four Rocket men, Luther Blissett, Steve Sherwood, Ian Bolton, Ross Jenkins. And I remember when I started doing interviews for the book and I went to see Ian Bolton, And he said, you know, the extraordinary thing about Graham was that he had this ability to make you exceed your own expectations of yourself. You know, you thought you were kind of capable of doing this. And Graham went, no, you're capable of much, much, much more. And he was right. So I think it's a kind of, it's a really inspirational story of what people are capable of with the right backing behind them. And there's no doubt that, you know, Graham was an absolutely inspirational club manager.
Do you think it's a story that would sort of translate maybe into a film or a series on Netflix or something like that?
I mean, I remember when I was writing it, yes, I kind of constantly thought, there's got to be a movie here. I wrote a book called A Very English Scandal, which was made into a TV series. And I had a very similar feeling with that. I mean, it wouldn't be my choice because basically it's up to Elton and David whether they want to do anything. Yeah, because I think that it's got a very touching story at the heart of it because, you know, here were these two people who couldn't, on the face of it, have been more different. You know, Elton was at the time the most flamboyant man in the world. Graham Taylor, quite possibly one of the most conservative. And yet they forged this amazing partnership. And, you know, and they really loved one another. It was a real kind of bromance. And Graham, who was not a kind of emotionally demonstrative man, said, I think he wrote in his autobiography, you know, I came to look upon him as the brother I never had.
Looking at Elton, I suppose, let's talk a bit about him and you working with him. You talk about Reg and you talk about Elton. Which one is the bigger Watford fan? Do you think it's Reg because of his dad? Or do you think it's Elton because of its football? And do you think there's a difference in Elton? Like when, you know, you said you spoke to him before, you interviewed him before, which was not about Watford, and then you do. Do you see a completely different Elton John or Reg when he talks about Watford?
I did feel that this was a story rooted in his childhood. So it seemed to me to be absolutely imperative to go back into his childhood and to kind of probe him quite deeply about it, which was, you know, I think was probably quite painful for him in some respects because he'd had this very difficult upbringing. His parents argued a lot and, you know, his bedroom in Pinner Hill Road was the one place where he would go and he would feel safe and he would keep all his Watford programmes in kind of immaculately arranged order. And indeed, he would actually talk to his programmes and kind of invest them with personalities and try and, as it were, soothe their feelings if he felt they'd become upset with all the noise from downstairs. And then, you know, he does this extraordinary thing where he becomes Elton John. And he buys the club, which is like almost like a story from kind of Greek myth. And I think there's no difference in at all in Elton's passion for Watford and Reggie Dwight's passion for Watford. One, although there were certain differences, I suppose, in, you could argue there are certain differences in Reggie Dwight's character and Elton's character. But I think that the through line between Reggie and Elton is absolutely consistent.
And when you hear him speak about players, for example, we've heard, you know, during the podcast, we've spoken to lots of the same people you have, and they always talk about Graham just wonderfully. And also the fun that Elton used to give them when they used to have parties. How did he talk about them? Did he speak about them as heroes?
You know, he felt very close to the players, but not as close to them as he felt to Graham. I think that he, to some extent, whether he kept his distance from the players, I think my feeling was that he felt closer to the supporters than he did to the players. He said on many occasions when we were talking how much he'd love to go to the supporters club and just talk to people there. He said, I felt more at home there than I did in my own home. The end of the evening or whatever, he'd get in his chauffeur-driven car and he'd be driven back to his house in Windsor where he still lives. For all his, you know, money and fame and all the rest of it, he was leading a pretty kind of isolated, lonely life. And I think that Vicarage Road was the one place where people didn't bow and scrape, where he could talk to them and they would treat him like a normal human being. And that was something that he valued enormously. And in a funny kind of way, just as his bedroom had been his sanctuary as a child, Vicarage Road became his sanctuary when he became Elton John. You know, he felt safe there, and he didn't really feel safe anywhere else.
Do you think people understand just what, how much of a supporter he is? And did that change for you when you were speaking to him? Did you surprise you in any way?
I mean, he knows, I don't know, what Aldershot were doing last weekend. He knows everything. And actually, David Furnish told me he and Elton had gone to a dinner once, and they'd sat next to, I think Jose Mourinho was between them. Elton went off to go to the loo at one point, and Mourinho turned to David and said, "Jesus, he knows more about football than I do." And he really does know everything. Because he came to Vicarage Road the other day and he talked to Gary Lineker and Peter Crouch and everything like that. And David sent me an email beforehand saying how much Elton was looking forward to talking about football. You know, it's one of the things he loves most in his life. I think that he's as proud of what he accomplished at Watford, what he and Graham accomplished at Watford, as he is of his musical career.
What was your favourite story he told you?
I think the favourite story he told me, because it was really the moment which cemented the friendship between Graham and Elton. And it had been slightly written about before, but not very much. I think Graham alluded to it in his autobiography, where one Boxing Day, Elton came in for a board meeting. He'd basically been hitting the bottle, but he'd also bought himself this brand new coat for £1,500, which he was very, very pleased with. When Graham walked into the boardroom, Elton was there drinking whiskey, I think it was whiskey, at about sort of 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning prior to a board meeting. Graham, who knew nothing at all about fashion, took one look at this coat and assumed that Elton was still wearing his dressing gown, marched over till there was a drinks cabinet there, and he got a bottle of brandy and he slammed it down on the table in front of him and said, "That's what you have for breakfast, isn't it? What are you doing to yourself? You're letting yourself down, your family down, the club down, and so on and so forth." And, you know, as Elton said, he would never have taken it from anyone else. You know, he was a global superstar by this point, lived in his own sort of hermetically sealed universe. And yet when Graham was tearing a strip off him, and as Elton always said, you know, Graham had a really ferocious temper, you know, Elton just sat there with his head bowed and took it. Although it was another 8 or 9 years before he actually went into rehab, he's in no doubt whatsoever that that was the impetus that kind of set him on the road to recovery. Graham had been worried before he did, because he could see that Elton was drinking a lot and was kind of letting himself go. And he discussed it with Rita, his wife, about, should I say something? Because, you know, Elton was the chairman and Graham was the manager. And, you know, it was a very tricky thing. Elton could have just turned around and said, "Right, that's it, chum, you're sacked." But actually, it deepened their friendship. And I think it left Elton more desperate than ever to earn Graham's approval.
So Graham was his older brother.
Yeah, but I also think that he, I mean, you know, there's a story in the book about how Elton's dad was this kind of remote, rather kind of emotionally buttoned up man. And he, when Elton became famous, he never said anything to him. And then, you know, there were sort of waves of disapproval came off him. And as a sort of, when Watford were in the Division One, they played Liverpool as a sort of last ditch hope of trying to rekindle a relationship with his dad. He invited him to the game, had lunch together first in the Adelphi Hotel in Liverpool. And he, you know, Elton really, really been hoping that, you know, even at this very late stage, that they could get their relationship onto some kind of, I don't know if it's back on track, because I'm not sure it ever really been on track, but, you know, and yet there was nothing. And it was as if the one person whose approval he sought more than anybody else, his father, never ever gave it to him. And I think that in some respects, Graham was the next one down in the pecking order. And he very much did get Graham's respect. And I think that that meant a huge amount to him.
That's the thing what I liked about the book. I know the story, let's say. You know, there's many people out there who listen to this podcast. If it's got Watford on the front of it or the side of it or wherever it is, they'll buy it and consume as much as possible. And I suppose I was expecting actually the book to originally be in Elton's voice. I had this thing in my head that, oh, it will be Elton telling his story. And it wasn't. And I actually liked that at the end. It was much more refreshing to sort of see the whole picture from that voice, that narrative, your voice, I suppose, from the outside.
To be honest, I never thought of trying to do it in Elton's voice because I just didn't think it was going to work. I think there were too many people who had to be brought into the story. You know, people like Ollie Phillips, and they were people, you know, Elton obviously knew Ollie Phillips pretty well and had a great deal of respect for him, but he was a much more kind of pivotal figure than I had realised when I started writing the book. And I also felt that Ross Jenkins, who was sort of, in many respects, he was the sort of archetypal Graham Taylor footballer, in that he'd been dismissed as this kind of, you know, the worst signing in Watford's history and so on and so forth. And he was headed for the scrap heap. And Graham kind of rescued him and turned him into an absolutely top class striker. And I was fascinated by the fact that actually they didn't get on that well. And I felt that, you know, in one sense, this was a fairy tale, but it was a fairy tale that needed a bit of bite to it. And the fact that they didn't get on that well did give it a bit of bite. And the fact that England in the late 1970s, early 80s, was as far from a kind of fairy tale landscape as you could get. So it just seemed very important to get that context in there.
And I suppose, you know, in this podcast, speaking directly to Watford fans, is there something you particularly, how would you like them to sort of look at it? What they can get from this book that they might not have got from previous books about Watford and that golden era?
I hope that it shines new light on the friendship between Graham and Elton that's at the heart of it. Because, yes, of course, it's a football. It's a book about football. But as much, if not possibly more than that, I wanted it to be a book about friendship, what each of them gave one another and how, you know, and how they enriched one another's lives. So, you know, yeah, that is what I would hope, I suppose, most of all, that people might take away from it. I mean, actually, the one thing I would say is, which is that there was supposed to be a bibliography in the book. You know, said all the books that I'd consulted and all the fanzines and everything like that, because, you know, I made a great deal of use of, you know, Lionel Burney's History of the Club and you know, lots and lots of fanzines, because Watford is has always been fantastically well served, it seemed to me, by its supporters, who've written extremely well about the club. And it would have been very difficult for me to write about it without what they'd done. And for reasons I do not understand, but it may be that the book was originally going to come out next autumn because there's a Disney Plus film about Elton, which I assume is about his farewell tour. And there's a book that goes with it. I have no idea what the book is at all. That was supposed to come out this autumn. Then for some reason it didn't. So there was a kind of mad rush to bring the book out in November in time for the Christmas market. And somehow, don't ask me how, the bibliography disappeared along the way, which, you know, I would hope that it's possible to kind of stick it back in for the paperback, because I do owe a big debt of gratitude to all those people.
From the Rookery End, a podcast about life following Watford FC.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, thank you, John.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
And we're back, maybe. Oh, we might do a podcast on Tuesday. Depends if Watford win or not.
How dare you?
Ely. 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 Come on, you uns.